ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci alongside Connor Kelly. As always, thank you so much for joining us. We have a lot to get to today. You may have noticed there was a little bit of a wobble in the stock market last week. Connor, we got all of the typical reactions. There was a CNBC Markets in Turmoil special. We saw some of the usual perma bears running victory laps. Of course, the nightly news was leading off with these frantic stories of a market bloodbath. Social media was in a frenzy. Now, I double-checked just to be sure, but even after last week's 4% plus drop, the S&P 500 is still positive for the year. It's up 5%. That might surprise a few people.
Well, and even if, put it this way, even if the stock market wasn't positive for the year, it seems like the last several years, people have short-term memory, right? People have forgotten what a normal market environment looks like. Stocks go down sometimes. You tweeted out a great stat from J.P. Morgan last week. The average intra-year decline since 1980 for U.S. stocks is almost 14%. Okay, that's on average. That's how much stocks can decline in any given year. Now, look, I know we're not trying to make light of this. I mean, these losses are real, and people certainly feel them in their portfolios, but it's the media hoopla surrounding these declines that really kind of get under our skin. And maybe we will have a big decline at some point, or better put, we will have a decline at some point, but nobody knows for sure when that might happen, and that's really what we're trying to make light of here, Nate.
Yeah, and it is a matter of when, right? We know for sure, at some point, we'll get a real meaningful down move in stocks. However, I'm going to go out on the limb and say it's not going to happen when everyone is sitting on pins and needles waiting for it to happen. It just seems like every time there's a 3-4% drop in stocks, there's a camp of investors who think the next big crash is here, right? And the financial media is just waiting to pounce. That's really what I'm mocking. You know, the fact is 3-4% drops and even 10 to 15% drops, as you mentioned, those are perfectly normal. Nevertheless, we will spend a few minutes today discussing some of the concerns floating around out there, namely rising interest rates. We'll do that in the back half of the show. But first, in just a moment, we'll be joined by Sumeet Roy, who's an analyst with ETF.com. We're going to delve into commodities and commodity ETFs. As it turns out, besides U.S. stocks, commodities are one of the few asset classes that are positive so far this year. And if you look, oil in particular has been on a tear. Also, gold finally did what it was supposed to last week. It reacted pretty well to the sell-off. So we'll discuss all of that with Sumeet. And I also want to ask him about Granite Shares reducing the cost on their physical gold ETF to, listen to this, 0.1749%. That created a little bit of buzz. Also on the program today will be Vince Burley, CEO of Vidant Financial. They offer a unique approach to ETFs where they're looking for companies with high quality leadership, strong corporate governance and accounting, attractive valuations. They call this a principles-based approach. So we'll dig into their investment process and look at several of their ETFs, including the Vidant Core U.S. Equity Fund. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com. Or you can find us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. All right, let's talk commodities with ETF.com, Sumeet Roy.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s.
For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Sumeet, great having you on ETF Prime today.
Thanks so much for having me, Nate. Pleasure to be here.
All right, so a lot we're going to try and cover. Let's maybe start with broad-based commodities. I was looking at flow so far this year into the largest commodity ETFs, and I would say overall they've been okay. The Invesco Optimum Yield Diversified Commodity Strategy, no K1 ETF, ticker PDBC, that's taken in over $1.7 billion so far this year, so that's had a great year. The iShares Commodity Select Strategy ETF, COMT, that's taken in close to $450 million. And then some of the other larger products like DBC have been less than that. But if you look at performance, at least compared to everything outside of U.S. stocks, broad commodities have performed pretty well. PDBC is up about 7%. What's your take on flow so far this year, and what have been some of the drivers of performance?
So let me start with flows, Nate. If you take the big picture and aggregate all the commodity ETPs, we're seeing about outflows of $1.2 billion for commodity ETPs as a whole and assets under management of about $59.7 billion. So if we compare that to previous years, in 2017, for example, we saw inflows of $1.5 billion. In 2016, we saw inflows of $10.4 billion. And then in 2015, we saw inflows of $339 million. So the fact that we have modest outflows this year isn't that impressive for commodity ETPs as a whole, but a lot of those outflows are coming from the gold exchange-traded products, which have the bulk of the assets. So if you exclude those, it's actually been a pretty decent year. Like you said, Nate, the broad commodity ETPs have had some pretty decent inflows. And when we talk about broad commodity ETPs, we're talking about those that are capturing or trying to capture the entire commodities market from energy to agriculture to metal, as opposed to ETPs that target only one specific commodity like gold or oil. Now, the broad commodity ETPs, I think they've been attracting interest for two reasons. One, that strong rally in oil prices that we've seen this year has spurred strong performance in the broad commodity ETPs because they tend to hold big positions in oil, and good performance is always going to get investors to take notice. Performance for the various broad commodity ETPs, it ranges pretty significantly because they all follow very different indices. Some are equal weighted, some are production weighted, and that's going to have a dramatic impact on returns. But they've ranged anywhere from a 12.7% gain for something like the IPAT, S&P, GSCI, Total Return Index, ETN, ticker symbol GSP, all the way to a 2.8% loss for the actively managed First Trust Global Tactical Commodity Strategy Fund, ticker symbol FTGC. That said, there's more commodity ETPs that are up this year than are down. So that's definitely, you know, attracting the interest of investors. And the second thing I'll say is that a lot of investors may be focusing on commodity ETPs now because there's a lot of talk about being late in the business cycle, and commodities, they tend to do well late in the business cycle as companies operate close to maximum capacity, pushing up the demand for raw materials.
Sumeet, any thoughts on why PDBC has been the leader in flows this year in terms of broad-based commodity ETFs? Do you think it's the no K1?
That's a good question, Nate. I mean, it's been an impressive flow story this year. For a fund that started with something like $740 million in assets to then go and take $1.7 billion in 10.5 months, that's nothing short of impressive. I think we have something like $2.6 billion in assets under management now in PDBC. So that rivals DBC as the largest broad commodity ETP on the market now. But it's really hard to say exactly why a product like this is suddenly getting so much traction. I mean, it's been around since 2014, so it's not a new product by any means. But I think, like you said, Nate, the no K1 factor is playing a part in that. It saves a lot of headache and paperwork come tax time. But the bigger benefit, I think, is the expense ratio. We talk about it for ETFs in general, but investors are very cost conscious. So the much lower expense ratio on PGBC of 0.59% compared to some of the other commodity ETPs that are out there, like BBC, which has a 0.89% expense ratio, I think for long-term investors, that's the bigger factor.
Going back to performance, as you mentioned, obviously oil has been a big driver in terms of the broad-based commodity ETFs. But, you know, it's no surprise if you look at the top-performing ETFs this year, there are actually quite a few oil-related ETFs on that list. Something like the Invesco DB Oil Fund, DBO, or the largest oil ETF, the United States Oil Fund, USO. Those are up 25-30%. Can you talk a little bit more about the specific drivers of oil? I know it's taken a dip recently, but overall it's had a great year.
Absolutely, a very strong year. I did a piece on the top-performing commodity. I'm sorry, the top-performing ETFs in general a couple of weeks ago, and eight of the top 20 were oil ETFs. So very strong performance there. And I think that's because, you know, we're seeing really strong demand for oil, you know, that's thanks to continued growth in the emerging world. But you're also starting to see supply strains by the economic crisis in Venezuela, for one, and also those upcoming U.S. sanctions that are going to hit Iran. That's crimping supply, or I'm sorry, exports over there. So I think over the last 2 years, Venezuela's oil production has dropped something like half by half. And then Iran's exports just in the last few months are down 40%. So you put those two together, really tight supply and robust demand, which for the first time topped 100 million barrels per day this year. That's creating a situation that the International Energy Agency is calling a very tight oil market. And the International Energy Agency, they put out an estimate for spare capacity in the oil market. That's basically how much oil that countries can quickly bring online to make up for any disruptions. And they say that's equal to only 2% of global demand, which is a very low level. So this is a market that's very prone to supply disruptions. And we are getting those disruptions in Iran and in Venezuela right now.
Well, the other interesting thing, too, here is if you look at the oil ETPs that invest in futures, the futures curve is in backwardation, right? And this can apply to any commodity ETP that uses futures contracts. Do you mind briefly explaining the benefit of backwardation?
Sure. And this is a great example of backwardation and the impact it could have on commodity ETFs. If you look at the U.S. benchmark, West Texas Intermediate for oil, WTI, it's up about 19% this year. But the largest oil ETF that tracks WTI, the United States Oil Fund, ticker symbol USO, it's up 26% this year. And that is because of the backwardation. So backwardation, it just describes the situation like now, when near-month oil futures contracts are trading at higher prices than later-month oil futures contracts. And that means that when oil ETFs roll their futures positions from one contract to the next, they sell at the higher price and buy back at a lower price. And that results in a net gain that adds up over time. We call that the roll yield. The opposite situation, which tends to occur a little more often, it's called contango, and that's when near-month futures contracts are trading at a discount to later-month futures contracts. In that case, oil ETFs sell at the lower price and buy back at a higher price, resulting in a loss or a roll cost. Generally speaking, when traders are nervous about securing supplies, oil tends to trade in backwardation. And when markets are flush with supply, contango is more typical.
We're visiting with ETF.com, Sumeet Roy. Sumeet, lastly, I do want to go back and talk a little bit about gold. So I feel like gold has reacted somewhat oddly this year. It just hasn't done what maybe investors would have expected. Now, my pet conspiracy theory is that cryptocurrencies are impacting gold, maybe a little more than people think. But in any event, Gold did react well to last week's sell-off. It was up close to 1.5%. You mentioned the outflows from gold ETFs year-to-date. Anything else noteworthy you're seeing in terms of ETF flows or any thoughts on the price action in gold?
Yeah, it's been a pretty disappointing year for gold, Nate. I think year-to-date, I last checked, we're down about 5.8% on gold. Like you said, that is up from the worst levels. I think we were down 9% in September. The thing about gold is there just hasn't been much of a reason to own it. Interest rates are going up, as everyone is well aware, and economic growth in most of the developed economies has been steady, if not better than steady, like here in the U.S. So that sapped a little bit of the safe haven investment demand that's become a really important of overall gold demand in recent years. So we do see that reflected in the ETF flows. The World Gold Council, they put out a monthly survey of flows into and out of ETFs. And according to them, about $1.4 billion has come out of physical gold ETFs year to date. But there's some divergence depending on the region you look at. Most of the money, $3.1 billion, has come out of North American, specifically U.S.-listed gold ETFs like GLD, for example. On the other hand, in Europe, we've actually seen net inflows of $1.9 billion into their gold ETFs. But still, overall investment demand has been waning globally, but it's not just investment demand. The World Gold Council also said that overall demand, which is going to include jewelry and demand from central banks and things like that, is actually at the lowest level since 2009 this year. So whatever it may be, you know, whether it's Bitcoin taking demand from gold or whatever the case may be, it sure seems like gold has fallen sharply out of favor this year. But finally, I'll say that, you know, I have to wonder whether, you know, now with gold still out of favor, is the time to be buying gold? Because if you consider it an insurance policy, you want to be buying insurance when it's cheap, right, rather than chasing it, you know, when something bad happens and then gold runs up. So from that perspective, investors may want to take a look at gold ETFs now.
No, I think you make a good point. And we always say gold's one of those asset classes that just marches to the beat of its own drummer, right? It's really tough to predict what's going to be the specific catalyst. But if you look historically, certainly it served as a good crisis hedge. And, you know, some will argue it's been a good inflation hedge. Any thoughts on the price cut from Granite Shares on their Gold Trust ETF ticker BAR bar? They cut the fee last week from 0.2% to 0.1749%, which now makes it the lowest cost physical gold ETF on the market. Right, it's cheaper than the Spider Gold Mini Shares and the Perth Mint Physical Gold ETF, which launched earlier this year. Both of those are at 0.2%. Do you think we'll continue to see this sort of back and forth on gold ETF fees?
It's funny, Nate. Like you said, you had Granite Shares, you know, make this fee cut. But the story is that, you know, they were the low-cost option in the gold space when they debuted in August of last year, I think at 20 basis points for the fee. Then those two competing products came out, GLDM and an AAAU, and they undercut BAR with an 18 basis point fee. So Granite Shares comes out earlier this month, and they slashed the fee on BAR to 17.49 basis points, reclaiming the title as the lowest cost gold ETF. Now, on the surface, all this maneuvering a basis point here or there, it seems kind of ridiculous, but when you look at the evidence across the ETF space, and you know this, and because I'm sure you talked about it on the show, investors care about every basis point when it comes to fees. I mean, you had BAR accumulate $285 million in assets pretty quickly by being the lowest cost gold fund. So it's no surprise that they want to keep those assets flowing. And by reclaiming that title, it kind of helps them do that. It's just another sign that, you know, the ETF EUR is still very much going strong. It doesn't matter what asset class or segment of the market you look at. Investors like these lower fees, and ETF issuers are all too happy to accommodate them.
So do you think this might start a trend where we see fee cuts made in the thousands of basis points?
It wouldn't surprise me, Nate. I think whatever it takes, the ETF issuers are going to do that. And, you know, I think it's going to resonate with investors. If you're the lowest cost ETF in a segment, whether it's half a basis point, even half a basis point, I think, you know, investors are going to take notice, and that's going to help attract assets.
Well, Sumeet, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Great perspective on commodities and commodity ETFs today. Look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks again, Nate. Pleasure to be here.
That was ETF.com, Sumeet Roy. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Vince Burley, CEO of Vidant Financial. We'll look at their unique principles-based approach to ETFs. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci and Connor Kelly in studio. We are now joined by Vince Burley, CEO of Vidant Financial. Vidant currently offers five ETFs. Those ETFs have nearly $2 billion invested in them, led by the Vidant Core U.S. Equity Fund, ticker VUSC. And Vidant takes a unique approach to ETFs where they're looking for companies with high-quality leadership, strong corporate governance and accounting, attractive valuations. They call this a principles-based approach. Vince is joining us via phone today from Atlanta. Vince, a pleasure having you on the program.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Vince, before we delve into some of the Vidant ETFs, your company has a unique structure. So as I understand it, Vidant Financial is owned by a trust. That trust has a group of industry professionals who are responsible for ensuring Vidant takes a principles-based approach to investing. And then they also ensure profits go back to reducing operating costs or improving your overall investment process. I think the point being, all of this for the benefit of Vidant investors. To me, that sounds a bit Vanguardian. Are there some parallels here?
There are. I read Mr. Bogle's books and had a lot of impact on me. And coming out of the wealth management industry for 30 years where I was thinking of, you know, we really are a fiduciary. I wanted to make sure that we were a fiduciary for our shareholders, and those shareholders being ETF shareholders, not the shareholders that own our company. And as Mr. Bogle said, you'll serve one of two masters. You either serve the fiduciary that owns you or serve the fiduciary that you're serving. And we just reduced that to one fiduciary role, and that is for ETF shareholders. And so that is the one piece of Vanguard that we really liked. And so we set up a trust to make sure that that's how the profits and the principles would be preserved.
All right, so when we talk about a principles-based approach to investing, explain for us what that means. What's the overarching idea here?
Well, I think the overarching idea is that we really wanted to come up with a process that increased the probability of investors meeting their goals. And those goals are not necessarily market-related, like alpha or beating the market, as much as actually having their money when they're going to need their money. And what are the things that are going to help us to accomplish that? And so we start with principles around uncertainty and instability, knowing that markets can be very volatile economies. 08s, 09s are going to happen. So what are the things we really got to make sure that we do to actually protect ourselves against that? True diversification. So like we never have more than 0.5% in any one company or security that we're invested in. Where's wealth created? Wealth created by human productivity. Where leadership and governance and sense protects and dignifies those people. So we're looking really closely at leadership like boards and leadership models that are actually encouraged to be a steward for shareholders rather than maybe just empowering their own selves. And then we actually look for good value out there. So we really know that that's a big key indicator for investors getting their goals. So principles guide us in every one of our indexes and make sure that we have certain aspects in every one of our indexes so investors can know that they're going to be there and have a high probability of getting their returns.
Vince, as you walk through that, you mentioned leadership and governance. To me, there seems to be a bit of an ESG philosophy underpinning your approach. Do you think there are some similarities here with ESG?
Yeah, we found out we were ESG. We didn't intend to be ESG. I think we're on the G side more. That's the governance. For those that don't know what ESG is, environmental social, I think, is probably more for investors looking for a cultural, more global impact in the world. That isn't embedded in our process. But for people that are looking for G, that governance, where they care a lot about what boards and leaders are doing, are they treating their employees right, are they acting as stewards for shareholders, we are a good fit for ESG investors that are looking for that type of governance score.
Our guest is Vince Burley, CEO of Vidant Financial. All right, so as I mentioned, your largest ETF by assets is the Vidant Core U.S. Equity Fund, ticker VUSC. Let's talk about the construction of this ETF. Tell us how holdings are selected and how they're weighted.
Yeah, so we start with a pretty broad universe of U.S. companies, and then the first thing we do is we screen out companies that have the worst leadership governance scores. It leaves us with a new universe. And then we're looking for companies that have had a history of creating consistent profits, have a good balance sheet where they're avoiding excessive debt, and is lower priced than their peers. So this is a fund that is not going to be very top-heavy with a big tech companies or, you know, hoping for future profits as much as we're looking at companies that have a history of making profits at a much lower P.E. ratio.
Vince, as I was looking through the prospectus on this ETF, I noticed that one of the screens you have is excluding companies that have extreme risks. So if a senior executive has been dismissed or faces prosecution for personal misconduct, or if a company is late in SEC filings or under investigation, and I couldn't help think of Tesla. And I'm guessing Tesla probably would have screened out just on your valuation screen. But yep. Is that a good example of a company that would be excluded because of those extreme risk factors?
Yes, Tesla was one. We also have, you know, banks are susceptible to this. So Wells Fargo was another one that we were not in. So those are the kinds of things. Equifax was another company that we weren't in because of those reasons.
Okay, now you also offer the Vidant Core International Equity ETF, VIDI. Is this effectively running the same screens and process as a U.S. version, just using international stocks?
It is, except for we actually start at the country level, and our research found out that actually your country allocation is your biggest indication of future performance rather than sector and security selection in international equity. So we run a heavy screen on countries, and we weight every country based on their leadership and governance scores. So you're going to see us own a lot more opportunistic countries than maybe a cap-weighted approach that is primarily going to own Japan and the United Kingdom. We're going to be in countries like Thailand, Singapore, South Korea, Norway, Ireland, things that we see that are actually have better leadership and governance future than some of the other economies that are just larger ones.
Now, on the fixed income side, you also offer the Vidant Core U.S. Bond Strategy ETF, ticker VBND. Is this also considered a principles-based ETF? Does this fall under sort of the same umbrella as the equity ETFs?
It does. The biggest similarity is that on the credit when we look at issuers, we look at the credit scores based on the leadership and governance scores rather than just the rating agencies. And then we also look at a broader level of sectors, including both high yield and TIPS in our fund.
Okay, and we have just a few minutes left here. I also want to ask you about your most recent launch, the U.S. Diversified Real Estate ETF, ticker PPTY. This just launched in March. It already has $80 million invested in it. Now, to me, REITs are an area where there are certainly some well-entrenched ETFs on the market. So what makes the Vidant REIT ETF different?
Yeah, we really saw an opportunity there because most of the REIT products are cap-weighted, again, based on the size of the REIT. And when I think about real estate, I think about, you know, where's the what kind of property type am I going to own, residential, office, industrial, retail? You know, where is it going to be owned? Location, 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 and then leverage. And so rather than starting with the REIT, we actually started with looking at the underlying real estate in the REIT and then had a fixed allocation we wanted in each one of those property types, leaned into cities that were actually growing and had reasonable priced real estate, and then make sure we moderate the leverage And so that's how we do our REIT weighting rather than just looking at the size of the REIT.
Vince, as I look at Vidant's overall ETF lineup, obviously we covered some U.S. Or your U.S. equity ETF. You have an international equity ETF. I believe you have a forensic accounting ETF. There's a bond ETF and a REIT ETF. How do you see your overall approach to the ETF market? Is you think about where Vidant may go moving forward. How are you approaching the ETF market?
Yeah, well, I think the ETF is really back to the fiduciary side. The ETF is really the investor's friend. It is a remarkable innovation that helps you get the exposures that clients are looking for in a very transparent, tax-efficient, and cost-efficient manner. So what we're looking for is anytime we can find exposures that make sense for clients to have in their portfolio. Advisors like to use us in their portfolio construction because they know what they're going to get. Investors use our funds because they know what they're going to get when they get us. So as the future goes, we're looking for any time there's exposures that principals can be a benefit, as well as we can implement it in a way where people are going to want to buy this product.
Well, Vince, a pleasure having you on the program today. Certainly appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was Vince Burley, CEO of Vidant Financial, and you can learn more about their ETF lineup by visiting VidantFinancialSolutions.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, Connor and I will have our market update. This is ETF Prime. You're keeping in step. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Connor in studio. Let's go right to our market update.
Now it's time for the market update, where we bring you what you need to know from financial markets around the globe.
All right, so last week the S&P 500 was down over 4%. And before we get into any of our discussion here, I know I mentioned this at the top. I just want to reiterate. Look, market declines are normal. If you invest in stocks, you should expect a 10 to 15% decline at some point every single year. And then I would say every decade, you should be prepared to see a 30% drop or even two. Mm-hmm. That's normal. That's part of the deal when you invest in stocks. So let me say that up front.
Yeah, and look, it's not always clear why stocks drop, especially in the short term. I mean, you and I can sit here and speculate, Nate, and we will, but you know what could be driving returns looking forward. But at the end of the day, we don't always know what causes stocks to go up or go down in any given short-term period.
Yeah, I mean, the point here is stocks can go down. They can go down significantly, and we don't always know why that's the case. Now, that said, I do think it's good to be educated on what's going on, right? You don't want to have your head in the sand. And I do think understanding what some of the potential drivers are can actually help you stick with your investment plan because you're not in the dark. Right. So let's talk about some of the potential concerns right now. And what seems to be the biggest concern is rising interest rates, which is something we touched on last week. But let's dig a little bit deeper here.
Yeah.
So at a high level, interest rates are rising because the economy is doing well. The latest measure of GDP clocked in at a 4.2% annualized growth rate. Unemployment is near 50-year lows. Corporate earnings remain strong. And so because of that, we've seen a rise in interest rates. You have the Federal Reserve trying to make sure the economy doesn't overheat. They don't want inflation getting away from them, so they're hiking short-term rates. And all of that's fine. But here's the thing. Rising rates make borrowing money more expensive. So if you want to take out a mortgage, get a car loan, if you have credit card debt, if you're a business who borrows money, all of that becomes more expensive. So to give you an example, I checked mortgage rates yesterday. A 30-year fixed rate mortgage is now close to 5%. A year ago, it was less than 4%. So if we just take a 1% difference here, assume it's a 1% difference, The difference in a monthly payment on a $300,000 mortgage would be about $200 a month. And if you think about that, maybe that pushes some people past their threshold, past their budget, and they stop buying houses. I think that kind of gives you an idea as to how rising rates can impact things.
And to take your analogy or example a step further, it's not just buying or not buying a house. It goes further than that. So suppose this, you know, couple or investor decides not to buy a new house. Well, guess what? They don't have to go furnish their new house.
That's right.
And they don't have to go to Home Depot, right, to load up on tools or a lawnmower, whatever, if they were previously renters. There's a trickle-down effect when it comes to home sales declining. Now, real quickly, I do want to make one point. Before 2008, 30-year mortgage rates have never been below 5% in history. So it's obvious that we are coming off historical lows, right, in terms of mortgage rates, that 5% has gotten, you know, made some headlines that mortgage rates are back above that. But again, we're coming from a historically low point in mortgage history. But you're, you know, the idea you're bringing forth is valid, Nate, that if people are home buyers or especially first-time home buyers and think, man, well, a year ago, this could have cost us 3.8%, 3.9%, 4%, and now it's 5%, that can cause some hesitation from potential buyers. And we are seeing that in the home sales data for sure.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. If you had a 5% mortgage in 1980, you would have been doing cartwheels, right? But everything is, you know, based on your perspective today, and you're not comparing yourself to somebody in 1980. You're comparing yourself to the situation, you know, over the past several years. And, you know, as you think about rising interest rates, you can play this out with everything, right? I mean, again, cars, credit cards, corporate expenditures. If the costs of borrowing rise, ultimately, that does have a negative impact on the economy and can cause a broader downshift. And, you know, the thing here is the stock market doesn't want to see a downshift in the economy because that ultimately hurts corporate earnings. So I think if we're to recap here, the first part of the recent turmoil we're seeing is really just investors' concern rising rates could take the punch bowl away.
Right. And what the Fed is trying to do here is what is called, you know, getting to a period of normalization or normal rates. And we can debate what that really means, right? But they're trying to walk a tightrope to get this right. The economy runs in cycles. It always has. It always will. And, you know, at some point, when rates rise later in an economic expansion, it starts to choke off and slow down growth. And then guess what happens? The growth slows down, rates turn back and go lower again, and that spurs growth, you know, kind of rinse and repeat. That's the cycle of the economy and, frankly, the cycle of credit, where periods of expansion are followed by retraction. And, you know, the fact is the Fed is, again, trying to get us off of a historically low interest rate environment. And thus far, I think most people would agree they've done a pretty good job doing that. But we saw this little spike in interest rates the last week or two with the sell-off in stocks, and it has certainly gotten people's attention.
Yeah, and I think if you go back, look, we've said this before, I think the Fed has done an excellent job navigating the country through the financial crisis. If you look at the stimulus, you look at what they did with interest rates, I think if you were grading them, you'd have to give them an A. But now here we are where they're removing that stimulus, rates are coming up, and they have to get this right. And, you know, it's funny, last week we saw President Trump say the Federal Reserve had gone crazy. So he said, quote, "I think the Fed is making a mistake. They are so tight. I think the Fed has gone crazy. Actually, it's a correction that we've been waiting for a long time, but I really disagree with what the Fed is doing." And whatever you think about President Trump, this is actually going to be the debate, right? Whether or not the Fed is getting this right. Will they avoid a policy error? And, you know, they control the front part of the yield curve. Certainly investors control the back end of it. But I think that's why the market, why you have seen some turmoil. If we're going to speculate about why stocks are going up or down, I think you have to look at this with the Fed. Now, you know, that's the first part of investors' concerns. I think the other piece of the equation here is simply that as rates rise, that makes bonds more attractive relative to stocks. And I'll give you an ETF example. So if you look at something like Mint, which is the PIMCO Enhanced Short Maturity Active ETF, this thing has a duration of 0.3, so hardly any duration risk, and it's yielding 2.5%. So if you're a stock investor, and maybe you are a bit concerned that the market's run too far, well, guess what? That yield starts to look pretty attractive. And so maybe you sell some stocks and just scoop up your 2.5% yield, basically risk-free.
You know, you made a good point. There's two different groups here that are impacted by interest rates. You know, the first are borrowers, businesses looking to grow, people looking to buy a new house or a larger house, right? And that is the group that, you know, certainly drives economic expansion to a certain point. They are being hurt by rising interest rates. But on the other hand, savers have been absolutely destroyed by this low interest rate environment. Retired investors who need a decent, safe income, pension funds, insurance companies, you name it, there is another side to this low interest rate environment. And your point, Nate, guess what? Savers are starting to be in a better spot because of rising rates. We're 9 years into this bull market, and it could end tomorrow or it could go on another 9 years. Nobody knows. But if you're one of those investors who are thinking that, you know, this stock market run is getting a little long in the tooth, you can finally get paid to invest your money in short-term safe assets like CDs or bonds, or like you mentioned, Mint, which is basically kind of a souped-up money market. It's yielding 2.5%. The dividend yield of the S&P 500 right now is only 1.9%. So even if you didn't care whether stocks went up or down, you just wanted the safe, reliable income that they produced for you, that yield is only 1.9% versus 2.5% in what is almost a little bit more risk than a liquid money market. That is starting to turn the math for a lot of more conservative income-focused investors, and I think fund flows are going to really start showing us that, especially in the traditional higher-yielding areas like REITs, dividend-paying stocks, MLPs, things like that.
By the way, some people will debate you on whether or not the bull market is actually 9 years old.
Yeah, that's fair. That's something going on. Discussion for another show.
But, you know, here's the other piece of this, too, is as rates rise, yes, the income is greater for bond investors. But in the short term, you have that principal loss. And so it's an odd environment because interest rates, I think, are clearly impacting the stock market because of the two things we just talked about. At the same time, you may look at your portfolio and have bonds not performing so well. So it's great that you're going to pick up that yield longer term. And if you look, you know, if you're holding a bond fund over the long term, that higher interest rate will ultimately overcome mm-hmm. any shorter term capital loss or principal loss that you have. But it makes it painful in the short term, especially for a diversified investor.
Yeah, and a lot of investors throughout their entire investment life horizon have never experienced a rising rate environment like we're in today. You know, if you look at basically early 80s, 80, 81, 82, where interest rates peaked, we've essentially been on a straight line down until a couple of years ago, right? There were some blips along the way, but in that environment, it was really hard to lose money in bonds unless you did something pretty aggressive, pretty risky, or pretty stupid. And most investors, that encompasses their entire investment time frame. So this is a conversation I'm having with a lot of clients right now, is you need to be really careful in the types of bonds you own and what is called duration or interest rate risk, right? So to your point, Nate, yes, there are people that are experiencing losses in investment-grade bonds, U.S. treasuries, areas of the bond market that they've never really had to worry about, where you could just set it and forget it. But in a rising rate environment, the situation has turned 180 degrees, where you need to be very aware of the fixed income exposure in your portfolio.
But let's come back to what happened last week, and I just want to reiterate, you know, we saw a 4 or 5% drop in stocks. That's normal. Mm-hmm. It always cracks me up. We had, again, the CNBC Markets in Turmoil special. I don't remember seeing the Markets in Euphoria special when stocks were up 5%. you know, over a couple day period. And, you know, however old you want to say the bull market is, we have been in an environment where stocks have mostly gone up.
Mm-hmm.
And you look back in 2017 where stocks really went up with no volatility. The point being that what we saw last week is normal. And I'll say it 10 times because I think sometimes given the current environment that gets lost. So you just want to keep perspective. Don't let the talking heads sort of get you off your plan. And I also want to make a quick note about diversification, because while diversification hasn't worked great overall because U.S. stocks have been primarily the only game in town outside of commodities, it will at some point. And even last week, we saw gold hold up. We saw bonds hold up. Emerging markets were only down 0.5%. So that's the other thing here, too, is don't lose sight of that. All right. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. Two excellent guests for you next week. We'll first be joined by Tadas Viskanta, Director of Investor Education at Ritholtz Wealth Management. He's also founder of the popular blog Abnormal Returns. We'll talk investor behavior with Tadas. And then Ted Lucas, Head of Investment Strategies and Solutions for Hartford Funds, will spotlight their multi-factor ETFs. Until then, have a great week, everyone.